Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Brian Broder. Brian Broder is the author of Natural Causes, winner of the 2011 Autumn House Press Poetry Prize. Other Latitudes, winner of the University of Akron Press's 2007 Akron Poetry Prize, and the chapbook, So the Night Cannot Go On Without Us, from White Eagle Coffee Store Press. Recent poems and reviews have appeared or are forthcoming in Copper Nickel, Gettysburg Review, The Missouri Review, Pleiades, Quarterly West, Shenandoah, and Verse Daily. Brian curates the blog How a Poem Happens, an online anthology of over 150 interviews with poets. He lives with his wife in Cincinnati, where he is a George Elliston Fellow in Poetry in the PhD in English and Comparative Literature program at University of Cincinnati. Hi, Brian.
Welcome. Hi, Lauren.
Welcome to Prosody.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Yes, we're very excited to have you. So if you'd like to begin by reading us some poems.
Sure. I'll read... This poem comes from a biography of Nietzsche's that I read a few years back. It was a recently published biography, more or less. I think it came out in 2005-ish. And basically, I encountered this curiously short or brief passage in the biography that mentioned the first time Nietzsche proposed to a woman. And so this is me imagining another life for Nietzsche. Nietzsche in love. Strange to think of him as the young professor, genuflecting in some Basel salon to kiss the hand of Matilda Trapidoc, who giggled into her glove, her dark hair shining under the oil lamps. Soon after, he wrote to her from his rented flat, urging her to gather all the strength that was in her heart so she would not be frightened by the question he put to her, would she be his wife? Though no response survives, we know her answer. Nietzsche never married. Fled to Rapallo, where he sequestered himself in a grand gesture, letting his mustache burgeon from his face like a rare fungus. Nor can we blame Matilda, nor the others who refused him, for sparing herself a life with this man who believed his genius was in his nostrils and called himself the annihilator par excellence. So why do I blame her? 11 years his junior, she might have seen past his pale complexion to the Friedrich underneath, who once called love the most unjust condition in the world. I like imagining that other Nietzsche, requited, a family man, too tired at night to invent the Übermensch or kill off God. Think of the never-to-be-born Nietzsche children, Frieda and Alistair and little Franz, squealing as he kneels by their beds, his turn to read from Mother Goose, which puts them to sleep faster in French than German. He dozes too. Later, he dabs spit up from his sleeve as he wanders the marketplatz, humbled, sober. Perusing the cobbled stalls for some distraction, he promises himself he'll write tomorrow if he tastes one cake tonight, eyeing pastries on the confectioner's cart, prepared to bargain. In this book, too, there are a number of dramatic monologues, and so this next poem is one of those. It counts. It's called, He Asks the New Owner to Look After His Trees. I mean that stand of pitch pines off the garden. They were planted in the 19th century. Sometimes I'd imagine myself caretaker of pines in the White Mountains of California, those ancient Great Basin bristle cones. Ever seen what 4,000 years looks like? My wife Jenna and I drove west one spring to hike Inyo, and saw Methuselah, the oldest living creature in the world. We couldn't look at it for very long. Gnarled and knotted in the stony ground, it only resembled a living thing. When illness forced Jenna into bed, she looked unreal, as if an artist who'd never known her had carved her out of wood. Do you have a wife? I didn't think so. The week I buried Jenna at St. Bridget's, I gave her clothes away to Salvation Army. What they wouldn't accept, I brought out back and doused with kerosene in an oil drum. I thought of taking pity on my trees and burning them to their roots, digging up what's left and burning that too, burying the ashes. I couldn't bring myself to do it, though. pitted in the drifts. They were glazed with glass. Their needles ticked and shivered in the cold. I stayed so long I couldn't feel my feet. You'd think I was tapped. I even talked to them. I pressed my face into their fragrant branches until my beard was sticky with pitch. And here's another dramatic monologue, although it is not one of those Browning-esque, Robert Browning-esque dramatic monologues that has a you, an interlocutor, in the scene in which it takes place. Kandahar. I drove to Jacksonville to see my son before he deployed with Echo Company. He stood on the hotel bed with his boots on and shouted, "This is my rifle, this is my gun," and laughed as we cracked our cans together. Seeing his grown-up body hard from basic, I was proud. I'd never served myself. But later that night, his hands shook so bad he could hardly deal for a game of spit. I told him everything would be all right. What else could I say? His eyes were wild, his scalp all sandpaper without his curls. At home, I keep a framed picture of him on my desk in his old room, in office now. Leaning against a jersey barrier, he smiles with his helmet on, his face peeling, his teeth stained yellow from the cigarettes. Because he took the photograph himself, the shot's crooked, his long forearm extending out of view. Behind him, razor wire scraping the sky, planes floating in the blue. Last time I heard from him, he said he was calling from Kandahar. But where is Kandahar? I tried looking it up on the computer. All I found were facts, history. Soon after the DOD knocked on my door, I woke one night and roamed the empty house and found myself downstairs in his old room, flipping the light to make sure he was there. Seeing his bed replaced by cardboard boxes, I panicked for a second. Then I remembered. At my desk, I looked hard at his picture for something new, some small detail I missed. So this next poem is one of the many poems in this book, Natural Causes. All of these are from Natural Causes. So one of the many poems in this book that that have extraordinarily long titles. So here's one of those. Finding the handwriting of a woman I loved in a paperback she left behind years ago. It must have been our last summer together when we drank beers on the roof of our two-bedroom and took the first commuter train to the Greater Boston Family Planning Center. The green fluorescence made our faces flicker. Slumped in a chair, she leaned on my chest and said, "I'm going," and fainted, grinding her teeth. I didn't know what to do, so I stroked her shoulder as a nurse cracked a capsule of smelling salts. Next day, the forecast called for rain. We drove north up 1A to Plum Island and walked to the dunes marked Keep Off Dunes to flush out piping plovers from the beach grass because she said she wanted to see something endangered before it disappeared. We stayed on the shore and watched the storm drag in off the Merrimack and drop to the sand when lightning struck the spit off Little Neck, clinging to each other as the squall drenched us, the tide frothing closer up the beach, the lighthouse staring seaward with its one good eye. So this next poem has an epigraph from an amazing poet named Muriel Rukeyser. This poem is called After Rukeyser. The epigraph is, "I lived in the first century of world wars." After Rukeyser. I lived in the second century of world wars. I woke each day and dry swallowed my pills for hypertension and high cholesterol, and turned on my devices asleep on the desk to check the nighttime progress of the wars. It was like peering underneath a bandage at a wound that would not heal. I waited for myocardial dysfunction or septic shock to put an end to them, but the wars only changed names, addresses, currencies. I thought about the periods between wars, when munitions are stockpiled in storehouses, and the civilian population can forget. Then an unmanned drone missed its target and blew up another crowded marketplace, and I braced myself to feel the repercussions and felt no repercussions. I took issue with the Democratic Party's wartime positions and voted Republican. Then I took issue with the Republicans and voted Democrat. I tied a yellow ribbon to a poplar tree. I drove the long way home and sat in traffic in front of Sunrise Assisted Living and gazed into a window facing the street at a figure in a cotton gown and thought, human beings live too long today. I lived in the second century of these wars.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Brian Broder, reading from Natural Causes. Brian, what I'm really struck about in the beginning of your reading right now is these varied speakers that you're working with in your poems. It doesn't seem to be one collective speaker. Mm-hmm. Throughout the poems, there seems to be very individualized speakers in each work, especially the dramatic monologues. Yes. How do you see that? How did you make that craft choice? And how do you see that working as a whole in your collection?
Well, I'm the type of, call it short attention span or what, but I'm the type of reader, anyways, who enjoys collections that are varied as possible. And in a sense, I enjoy collections that can push the limits of what is unified and what isn't as a collection of poems, or even as a lifetime's work, as a body of work, as a corpus. So I enjoy collections that really push the limits and yet stay precariously unified. So that was, I think, you don't really necessarily think about this stuff when you're composing the poems, but certainly when you're trying to assemble a collection, that was on my mind, I think.
So how do you unify them? And what do you think makes them unified?
Yeah, this is a very difficult question. And the short answer is, I don't really know. And then the qualification of that answer is probably, I don't want to know either. I suppose it's something mysterious in the end. But to actually try to answer your question and not just dodge it, I guess I would say, themes certainly and form, things like this, images, mm-hmm. Things like this that give the collection a cohesiveness that maybe aren't there with the voices speaking in the collection, and the characters and the locales and all these various things. So I have poems that take place all over the world in this collection. Let's go France to Plum Island, Massachusetts.
Right. So I noticed that you're dealing with a range of geographies and a range of historical figures, mm-hmm. just in those few poems that you read. Do you seek out historical figures or writing poems about them? Does that come from just your own fun reading, like hobby reading?
Yeah. The more mysterious, poetic answer would probably be, oh, they seek me. For me, it really is. I think this was Randall Jarrell who said this. I'm not sure, though. I can't remember. But a poet's reading should be and almost has to be random. It's not systematic. It is not a scholar's reading. One thing leads to the next. And that's kind of how, almost associationally, it's a kind of associational reading. And that's sort of the reading that I practice when I'm not working on in this PhD program that I'm in now, which is ruining that. But that's okay. Still reading some good stuff.
Yeah. It was fun to sort of, I like the imagining of Nietzsche's life and mm-hmm. these never-to-be-born Nietzsche children that are running around. And I was just curious how that came about. I'm sure it came from just naturally reading Nietzsche and, having a speaker imagine what his life would be like.
Yeah, I think, too, there's some biographical stuff, not only from Nietzsche's life, but that poem was probably more about me than it is about Nietzsche. At the time, I was engaged to be married, and I was thinking about that kind of thing. How is this going to change my life? What kind of an influence is this going to have on my writing? Will I still, when and if we have children, how is that going to affect, this aspect of my life, and all of that. And so that anxiety, the poem kind of grew out of that anxiety. Well, I guess a confluence of two things, that anxiety that I just mentioned and reading the biography of Nietzsche and finding that passage.
It's interesting as poets and artists what we find vehicles for, mm-hmm. you know, what we're doing in our everyday life or reading that suddenly becomes a vehicle for this poem that we want, mm-hmm. this story that we, narrative that we want to tell. Could you read some more poems, please?
Sure. So this next poem, this, I guess you could say, you know, this is the poet speaking. Why not? A late spring. From my porch chair, I watch house finches squabble at the feeder for the last kernels of thistle seed, warring cheerfully for the topmost perch, little flecks of rust flaking from their play. Or is it serious? Since Saturday, the finches have devoured 13 pounds of sunflower. Now they're demanding more. So I pour my own concoction into the tube, which they seem to enjoy, peanuts and fruity pebbles. I imagine them incredulous at first, their bills inquiring over the crushed up grains before they dig in, learning to love the strange bounty like the growing Beijing middle class who've cultivated a taste for Pizza Hut. Once I tried a handful of raw millet and spat it back in the sack, too bitter for me. I wanted to taste the staple of this species who escaped from New York cages in the 1930s. I think of them invading Mastic Beach, breeding poolside, harrying the rich, who cursed them as they poisoned heated bird baths and hired men to hose their feces off their roadsters, which is one explanation for why the finches flee from the slightest movement, refusing my palm. They don't trust me. Who could blame them? But they need my charity in this bare season before the flowers fill the air with seed. And so they accept without question whatever crumb I toss them, tearing apart the crust of a stale bran muffin we share. Flittering on the eaves, the finches agree. Their fleet song says as much. Agree, agree. One call chasing another, all appetite, as they pipe above me, twittering, nearly free. Okay, so this next poem takes place in Lascaux, France, in the famous caves there. The man with the bird's head. He's the only human likeness at Lascaux, a birdman stick figure lying prostrate on the cavern wall, dead or playing dead, beside a crouching bison and a spear. Our guide, Marcel, tells the tour in English. The artists saw each figure in the rock before they painted them, each stag and stallion suggested in formations already there, and simply traced the outlines with a horsehair brush. Not art for art's sake, Marcel muses. They painted what they loved to hunt, which explains the bear and oxen, aurochs, goats. But the man? Huddling up to see the squiggle curving upward from his waist like an erection, we point and kick each other's heels, asking questions we know we'll never have the answers to. The floor sweats, smutted with a dank musk. Half blind under track lights, we squint at cracks in the calcite, whispering. Our voices echo louder than we mean. And here's another poem that is, you know, more or less the poet speaking. Although this kind of never happened. So here you go. The longest conversation I ever had with Yoshi. Leaning against the fence between our yards, he asks if I've heard of Olkiluoto, an uninhabited island in the Baltic where the Finnish government stores copper canisters of nuclear waste. He says they don't know how long the canisters will stay radioactive, if a million years is optimistic or not. But the good news is most scientists agree civilization will end before we find out. I haven't heard. He asks me, what's the single greatest achievement of Western culture? What could outlast Mount Rushmore, the Parthenon? Shakespeare, I say? Dante Alighieri? He laughs and shakes his head. Nuclear waste. Imagine, he says, some future non-human race excavating that site in search of clues of who we were, digging up those tunnels and prying open the canisters, we couldn't label dangerous in a way they'd understand. Years later, they'll climb into the light with artifacts and wonder why they're dying by the hundreds, then the thousands. Snipping his shears, Yoshi spits on the grass and walks the gravel path to his nasturtiums. I stay a while longer by the fence, watching him spray aphids from the shield-shaped leaves, the gray fangs of his beard widening as he smiles.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Brian Berter, reading from Natural Causes. Brian, there's a lot of things going on in your work, geographical location and the varied manifestations of that. And there's also, I feel like your speakers at times are imagining, using their imagination a lot, mm-hmm. as opposed to fixating on images that are in front of them or associating with the world that's directly tangible. Mm-hmm. So how do you craft that? Do you see your speakers working that way? Or?
Yeah, I think it's probably a good mix between, I don't know, what's around these speakers in their daily lives and also what's going on in their imaginations. And also, you know, since memory and the imagination are one, you know, we also have lots of recollections too. And there's also, a couple of poems address the kind of tenuousness of that relationship between the memory and the imagination. How do I craft those? I'm not sure. Spend a lot of time in the library, I guess.
But it's interesting that you have a sort of interest in that, mm-hmm. an interest in creating these imaginations of a speaker as mm-hmm. opposed to just a speaker that's just commenting on the, you know, writing a poem about yeah. the world in front of them. Mm-hmm. It takes a different entry point for a writer to go into an imagination, an imaginary world. What about the relationship of place? How do you see that working in your poems? Do you strategically pick places or do they just, you know, you write about Beijing and France? And
mm-hmm. I'm not sure. You know, that's a really good question. I'm not sure how the places actually come about. I mean, most of these places I've actually been to. But sometimes, you know, sometimes I haven't been to the places, so...
Right, that's your memory and your yeah, recollection.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, so I don't know. Yeah, so I think, I don't know. And also, a lot of the poems, you know, like stories, because some of them are very narrative. You know, they have characters, they have, they have locations, scenes, et cetera. And so... How I choose those scenes or how those scenes are chosen, I'm not exactly sure. But eventually there's kind of a epiphanic moment where I think, oh, this has to take place in Cincinnati, Ohio. It could never take place anywhere else.
That's interesting. So do you think of your poems as you're crafting them or as you're revising them perhaps as little movies, little scenes, like this is my setting, these are my characters?
I do.
That's how the narrative works.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the games that I'll play is, so what time of year is this taking place, you know? And that might not be expressed actually in the poem, in the finished draft, but it's certainly, you know, if you asked me, I could say, oh, yeah, that poem's, that's a fall poem, you know, even though there's no, you know, there aren't any roads diverging in a yellow wood or something, you know?
Yeah. That's very fascinating. Could you read a few more poems?
Sure. Here's another one of those poems with a long title. They're very, very James Wright-esque, I think. I'm not
I
sure.
I like long titles.
Yeah, good, good. Browsing the metaphysical eBay listings, I find holy relics for sale. I'm not sure if you're allowed to, you're not allowed to sell human remains online and on eBay, but I did actually find this online. So anyway, browsing the metaphysical eBay listings, I find holy relics for sale. A college friend who'd saved 10 years of his toenail clippings in a mayonnaise jar calls tonight to tell me his wife gave him an ultimatum, the jar or me. He says he thinks the counseling is working. His second honeymoon to Puerto Vallarta. Best, he says, to stick it out for the baby. And I get a hollow, kicked in the stomach feeling. It's okay, he says. We Catholics believe everything broken will be made whole again in heaven. I laugh. He laughs louder. I joke about how St. Philomena's teeth are going now for 1,300 each. asking him if he knew that when Philomena's grave was found 9 centuries after she died, the blood inside an urn set by her tomb was still moist. "Here's what I know," he says. "There are no words between two people that won't be misconstrued, corrupted, lost." Some nights, he says, he lifts the covers, slides in beside her, and feels her belly rise and fall. Sometimes she squirms against the coldness of his fingers. Sometimes, still asleep, she touches back. Here's a short, brief poem, if I can find it somewhere in this book. And this is actually based on and here's another example of those the poem where you wouldn't necessarily know, this takes place in spring, but it does, and it doesn't actually matter to the poem either. But there you go. There's some useless information. The boy without arms. From the metro station, he steps into the sun, his sleeves cut off, his hands dangling directly from his shoulders, stiff, unfinished. His hair is parted, clean. His pristine sneakers are double knotted, his shirt tucked into his jeans. Who helped him dress this morning? He turns around and looks into the crowd. I see her now. She's there, the caregiver, a woman following behind him to help him feed his change into the smart trip card machine for bus fare. His mother, by the same soft slope of the nose, the same spattering of freckles on her cheeks, the thoughtful distance she keeps between them, giving him room, but watching him and watching the others pass him on the curbside as he stoops to press the crosswalk button with his chin. Okay, one more brief poem. Housefly. Though it's caught between the storm window and screen, I gaze up every few minutes to check its progress, admiring its persistence, the urgency and ease of its clipped flight. At least the fly has the excuse of mindlessness for living recklessly, for coupling in a hurry, abandoning its young in garbage bins. This thought depresses me. Then the thought that it doesn't depress me enough depresses me. I can't help watching the fly preen its wings on the wire mesh, proboscis quivering, as it circles the reflection of my face and rams its tiny head into the glass. Crawling across what we can see of the cumulus outside, it seems to have finally reached the end of sky, that blue region where the vastness of the atmosphere finds a frame. Thinner than India paper, its wings blur as it rises to the pane.
The poetry of Brian Berter. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much, Lauren. It was great to be here.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody, 90.5 FM.